This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the 2 years since the attacks of 9/11, Thomas Friedman's columns have provoked admiration and outrage. Wednesdays and Sundays, the op-ed page of the New York Times is part of the infrastructure of the debate on foreign policy. The recipient of a third Pulitzer Prize last year, Tom Friedman has just published a revised edition of his book Longitudes and Attitudes in paperback. We'll devote much of the show to the changes that we've all seen in the past 2 years. If you'd like to join the conversation about the significance of 9/11 2 years on, about the still frayed relationships with old allies like France and Germany, about the administration's ambitious hopes for a democratic Iraq and the reality of an often bloody occupation, give us a phone call. Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Tom Friedman is with us here in Studio 3A, and welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Great to be here, Neil. My column appears on Thursdays and Sundays now, though we actually moved one day.
I'm sorry about that.
Close.
As it happens, this is the first day of the United Nations General Assembly. Delegates heard speeches from, among others, the Secretary General Kofi Annan and from the presidents of France, Brazil, and the United States this morning. President Bush laid out the case for greater U.N. assistance in helping Iraq to become a working democracy.
Success of a free Iraq will be watched and noted throughout the region. Millions will see that freedom, equality, and material progress are possible at the heart of the Middle East. Leaders in the region will face the clearest evidence that free institutions and open societies are the only path to long-term national success and dignity. And a transformed Middle East would benefit the entire world by undermining the ideologies that export violence to other lands.
In his address to the UN, President Bush also made it clear that the transition to democracy cannot be rushed or determined by, quote, the wishes of other parties. And Tom Friedman, the success of a free Iraq, the basis of that premise that he talked about there, it's still very much in doubt, isn't it?
It is one of the things that's always struck me, Neil, about the administration. It's the contrast between their reach and their grasp. Ideologically, they have the most bold and audacious vision. And as readers of my column know, it's a vision that I identify with. Regime change, trying to partner with Iraqis to build a progressive, decent model in the heart of the Arab Muslim world. And the stakes are enormous if we succeed, and I shudder to think if we fail. But if that's how I approached it, if the stakes were that large, if my own presidency were indeed on the line for this, I sure would have come at this post-war with not only a much more coherent plan about what I intended to do, but with overwhelming resources. The Powell Doctrine applied to nation building, not just war making. Overwhelming force, overwhelming security presence, and overwhelming economic resources, because we only have one chance to make a good first impression. And we've been doing our darndest to make it a bad one. And so, again, I'm struck by the contrast. This administration is great at describing the stakes, but I think it's been miserable at delivering the goods.
The voices who had urged a different timetable were among those that the president was addressing at the United Nations today, and this was an opportunity, if he wanted one, to make up for the bruises that were left in the past year, or not make them up, but at least try to rub some salve into the wounds and to offer concessions to bring the French and the Germans and the Russians back on track with a U.S.-sponsored proposal before the Security Council. The president offered no apologies today.
Yeah, you know, sometimes looking at the Bush administration in France, you're reminded of the Iran-Iraq war. You know, you just, can't figure out who you want to win. These guys, in fairness to the Bush administration, I think the French proposal, the obsession with moving quickly towards sovereignty for Iraq, there's something just not honest about this. The people who are attacking us in Iraq right now, Neil, are not people demanding a rapid move to sovereignty for Iraqis. They're not attacking us over sovereignty. They're attacking us over privilege. These are remnants of Saddam's regime. They're remnants of a Sunni Iraqi Muslim order that has dominated Iraqi politics for 1,000 years. And they understand that if this American nation-building effort succeeds, their dominance of Iraqi politics and all the privilege and the corruption that went with it is over. They're not fighting for sovereignty for the Iraqi people. They're fighting for privilege. I believe the administration is indeed fighting for the sovereignty of the Iraqi people, but they want to do it in an orderly fashion. And an orderly fashion means it's got to be based on certain minimum institutions and a minimum process that Iraqis themselves will believe is fair and produce the kind of consensual leadership that they aspire to. And rushing into this, I think, would be a huge, huge mistake. Let's just take what would happen. There's a 25-member governing council. It's a very weak group divided between exiles and Iraqis who lived there throughout the regime. If we were to pull out tomorrow, if we were to just say, guys, here's it, sovereignty is yours. We're not taking orders from you, you know. Mm-hmm. You would see the biggest food fight and power struggle within that 25-member governing council over who gets authority than you could possibly imagine. It would bring everything, I believe, to a grinding halt.
The biggest critic of the United States before the war and after, as you mentioned, Jacques Chirac, the president of France. And let's hear a little bit of what he told the General Assembly of the United Nations earlier today. He presented a spirited defense of multilateralism.
In an open world, no one can live in isolation. No one can act in the name of everyone. No one can accept the anarchy of a society without rules. There is no alternative to the United Nations. Multilateralism is crucial because it ensures the participation by all in managing the affairs of the world. It guarantees the legitimacy and democracy, in particular, when it is a question of deciding on the use of force or of laying down universal norms.
And this, another in a series of attacks on the Bush administration's policy of preemption that was presented today, and what it in fact did during the war with Iraq, which was proceeded without the blessings of the Security Council and specifically without the blessings of France.
Well, I agree with Mr. Chirac, Neil, that multilateralism is always preferable. And especially when you're taking on a project like nation building in Iraq, half a world away, you want as much legitimacy and as many partners and to be able to amass as many resources as you possibly can. You really want partners. And believe me, if I believe France, that all it wanted to do was to be our partner, I would love to have France by our side, because I think they bring a certain legitimacy, a certain experience, and a certain level of resources that would be really helpful. But color me cynical, but I simply do not believe that about this French government. I believe Jacques Chirac, he's wonderful on the principle, but I think in practice, I think he became intoxicated with the notion that France would become the great Uncola to America's Coca-Cola and lead the global opposition to the American behemoth. I think that is what France is about. I think France wants us to fail in Iraq. I think they want to see us stumble. I think they see themselves as our rival, and the weaker they are, the more sway France will hold on the global stage. If France were really out to be our partner, Neil, I would love to have them, but I don't believe this French government is.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's go to, well, I understand it's probably pronounced Jean in Durham, North Carolina?
Yeah, Jean Christian is my real name, yes.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for the pronunciation. Well, I'm glad to be able to address directly Mr. Friedman, because I've read his column last week, I believe, in the New York Times. And as a matter of fact, that column was published in my local paper, The News and Observer, and I even wrote to The News and Observer as a response to that, and the the listeners of NPR are going to be able to have that before the readers of the NNO. What puzzles me in Mr. Friedman's logic is that France, who was nevertheless warned as well as the rest of the world, proof of all practical matter, the U.S. not to go to war in Iraq because they thought it was a bad idea and for a lot of reasons. Now, nevertheless, if we are to believe Mr. Friedman, should join the U.S. under the U.S. agenda. Not, it's not like if Mr. Bush was going to the United Nations or to France, for that matter, and asking for their help by saying, what I would do when I want to have somebody's help, under which condition would you like to help me? But he doesn't do that. He goes there and he tells them people, well, you know, I would like you to help me by doing this and that and make sure that I'm still the boss here and in charge of everything. Does Mr. Friedman think that there is a chance in the world that anybody with half a brain would accept such terms?
Well,
it's a legitimate point. I had my druthers. I would have liked to see in the administration, as I wrote before the war, make a direct overture to France. I would have liked to see the president actually go to Paris before the war and put his case to the French public and to the French government. And I'd be very comfortable after the war, the president putting his case to the French people and the French government. I think it's a perfectly legitimate point. I happen to be very dubious that this French government, again, really means to cooperate with us. But I would accept that criticism that you'll never really know until you put it to the test in a meaningful and credible way.
Well, I have to agree with Mr. Friedman that it is probably true, and actually I'm thankful for the French government not to wanting to cooperate with the current president. I think that the French, as most of the world, as a matter of fact, want regime change in the White House because they don't trust that this president is out to bring peace in the world, nor democracy like he does, and they just can't have him as a partner, and they won't deal with him because let's not forget, for instance, because I made an analogy here that Mr. Bush has not really been elected as democratically as Mr. Arafat has, and yet we know who wants to get who not to deal with the other. So, I mean, I think that along the same lines, yes, France probably doesn't want to deal with Mr. Bush. He's right about that, but I do think that they have solid grounds for that.
Okay, Tom Friedman.
Well, just two things I would say very quickly. One is, who did Yasser Arafat run against? I must have missed that campaign. I don't believe he ran against anybody certainly of any note. So let's be serious here about who was democratically elected and who not. I wouldn't compare it to Yasser Arafat. Number two, it's true that France was against the war. It's because France is not interested in promoting democracy. It's not interested in promoting égalité, liberté, or fraternité in the Arab Muslim world. It never has. We may be on a complete fool's errand, Neil, in aspiring to bring a different politics to that part of the world in partnership with people there. It may indeed be a fool's errand. But I'd rather go down chasing that ideal than chasing the next oil contract for the next French oil company.
We just have a minute left in this segment before we have to take a short break, but I did want to ask, a lot of the speeches today, including Kofi Annan and President Lula of Brazil, talked about reform of the UN itself, in a sense responding to President Bush's criticisms of a year ago, the challenges, but in a sense talking, one of the reforms saying, we need to expand the Security Council. Is this something that the United Nations is going to do seriously, do you think, in the coming years?
UN reform, boy, you're talking about one of the all-time great evergreens.
Where would this program be without it?
I have no idea, how credible or serious that is. My standard answer on that, Neil, is that, look, the UN is us. We kind of talk about the UN as if it came from Mars and was planted here. The UN is us, and it will be what we invest it with.
We'll continue our conversation with Thomas Friedman after a short break and take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking with Thomas Friedman, a columnist for the New York Times, the author of Longitudes and Attitudes. The book is a collection of his columns from just before 9/11 and the 2 years since. We're going to talk about 9/11's place in history, the war in Iraq and its bloody aftermath, and where U.S. policy goes from here, should 9/11 remain the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is TOTN@npr.org. And why don't we go right to Mike, who is with us from Beverly Hills, Michigan.
Yes. Given the Machiavellian paradigm that exists in the Middle East that the British and Americans have created since World War II, why should I have any confidence that the government of Iraq is going to be any less corrupt than the ones that exist there now? I mean, I don't see nothing visionary, nothing wholesome about the Bush administration's attempts to redefine the map there. I mean, what gives me any hope for something better?
A very legitimate question. It's a question my wife asked me always when I kept saying it was the right war, but you have to do it right. And she said, I don't believe the Bush administration will do it right. So why are you supporting these people in the hope that they will do it right? Although, let me just say that seen from on the ground, I've been to Iraq now 3 times since the war started. The answer to that concern raised by the caller is institutions. And in fairness, the way we are approaching this is with an attempt to build real institutions. The Iraqi justice minister last week came out and said that he wants to have an independent judiciary. Well, there's no independent judiciary in the entire part of the world. Now, he may not know how to build it yet. We may not be able to help him build it. But you have to start somewhere. And when Iraqis themselves come out and say, we want to build an independent judiciary, that's a really good thing. And you really have two choices. And the question from the caller is a very legitimate one. Culturally, politically, historically, building democracy in that part of the world is a fool's errand. And you can believe that, but I would rather spend my energy trying to partner with people in that part of the world who want to make it different. We may not succeed, but to think that there aren't people there who understand what is right, who understand the institutions that need to be built, and who aspire to them is really wrong. And the Governing Council and the American Authority right now is working on an agenda to build those institutions. The caller is right. We should be very dubious. This is going to take a long time, too. This is not going to be a sprint. It's going to be a marathon. But I would rather go down trying rather than not, for one very simple reason. Excuse me, but 9/11 was brought to you by the status quo. All right. 9/11 was brought to you by business as usual in the Middle East. And what I tell you is not trying to partner with people there to construct a more decent governing reality, I think is to think that that's the only risky thing and that doing nothing isn't risky is a real illusion.
Mike, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
9/11, you've written that as some events recede in history, they look smaller and less significant than first we thought. Others become magnified, and we see them in new ways as they resonate down the months and weeks afterwards. 9/11, you say, is more important now than even we thought 2 years ago.
Yeah, it really seems to have changed so many things, Neil, in our lives, you know, from the way we get on airplanes to the fact that my daughter's high school orchestra trip was canceled last year out of a fear of terrorism, to the way buildings are going to be designed. I wrote on September 13th that September 11th was the beginning of World War III. And I do believe it represents the third great totalitarian challenge in the last, 60 years. The first was the challenge of Nazi totalitarianism to open societies, a totalitarianism motivated by the crazy vision of installing the perfect race, the German race, in a dominant position and using the engine of Nazi Germany to do it. And we beat that back. And the second great totalitarian challenge to open societies came from communism and the communist totalitarian systems who wanted to install the perfect class, the working class. And they used the engine of the Soviet Union to try to do it. We now face the third great totalitarian challenge. It is religious totalitarianism. It is a group of people who want to install the perfect religion, Islam, in a kind of global caliphate and a dominant position. And they want to use the engine of groups like Al-Qaeda, feeding off charities and the passive support of many people around the Arab Muslim world, in order to do it. And we have to beat that back like we beat back the other two, because it is a fundamental threat to open societies.
Yet at another point in one of your columns, you write about the bubbles that burst in 2002. And one of them, you said, was the terrorism bubble.
Well, there were, I believe, three great bubbles in the 1990s, Neil. There was the NASDAQ bubble. There was the Enron bubble, the corporate governance bubble. And there was the terrorism bubble. And all three were based on creative accounting. The terrorism bubble was based on moral creative accounting. And the terrorism bubble really began to inflate with the attack on American troops at Khobar Towers and East African embassies. And it reached its apex on 9/11. And the terrorism bubble basically said that plowing airplanes into the World Trade Center is okay. Wrapping yourself in dynamite and blowing up Israelis in pizza parlors is A-okay. Having your charities raise money for people who do those things is just fine and dandy. And calling people who do those things martyrs in your own press and houses of worship is just wonderful. And not only did many, many people in the Middle East believe that was all okay, they believed it was actually going to level the balance of power between them and us. And I believe that bubble motivating people to do things that threaten us, was a fundamental threat to our open society. And there was no wall high enough, no metal detector smart enough, no border guard efficient enough to protect us ultimately by people motivated by that bubble. And what we had to do, I believe, at some point, was to go into the very heart of that world and burst that bubble. And the message was, ladies and gentlemen, which part of this sentence don't you understand? We are not going to sit back and let people motivated by that bubble threaten an open society we have built over 250 years. We really like our open society. We mean no ill to you, okay? But we are not going to sit back and let that bubble fundamentally distort our open society and imprison us. And that's what I believe, ultimately, this war was about. And guess what? People there got the message. Okay, in the neighborhood. This is a rough neighborhood, and sometimes it takes a 2x4 across the side of the head to get that message. But they got the message, and the message was, you will now be held accountable. And one can see that in Syria, one can see it in Saudi Arabia, I think one can see it in Iran.
Let's get another caller in. Paul joins us from Marin County in California.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I have so much to say. I want to talk about the roots of terrorism, and it seems to me like maybe the fourth bubble that burst on September 11th was a bubble of the notion that American aims around the world are always altruistic. It seems to me, Tom, that we don't have a notion, and it's a common human of frailty, of how our actions affect others on this globe. You know, I saw a movie called September 11th with 11 short films about different filmmakers' notions of September 11th. And one of them that struck me so much was a man from Chile who showed how on September 11th, 1973, 30 years ago, on a Tuesday, as a matter of fact, we overthrew the government, the duly elected government of Allende, how Kissinger went down and congratulated Pinochet on a job well done, you know, arguably one of the five worst dictators of the 20th century, Mr. Pinochet. We don't see how our actions affect what people decide to do. Now, this terrorism bubble that you speak about, it's not out of the blue and out of something that's just a whim. It's not just a bubble. When people are wronged over and over again, they tend to act out and to get annoyed by it, obviously. I mean, we as Americans particularly understand how treading on us is not okay. We were born out of that statement.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are people who are being fed vicious, racist, terrible things about the United States that are not true, and that has to be taken into account. But how about, as Jesus said, looking at the board in one's own eye, before the speck in the other's eye, and how that affects the actions and the decisions of others to strap on some dynamite or whatever they're going to do. And just by way of introduction, I'm the son of a Holocaust survivor. I know intricately and intimately from my father about injustice and what was done to him. It's imperative to not, you talk about the fool's game or the fool's errand. Perhaps it's a fool's notion to think that the United States, with all its many, commitments and adhering to things other than the loftiest of goals at times, is going to do the loftiest of things in the Middle East and particularly in Iraq.
All right, Paul, let's get a response. Okay.
Yeah. Well, these are legitimate points. Again, anyone who's reading me knows that one of my mantras from the very beginning. Even before the war, is that if we're going to summon the world to a war on terrorism, we darn well better be the best global citizens we can be. You can't go out to the world and say, look, folks, there's a war on terrorism now because of September 11th, and you're either with us or against us. But by the way, in that war for a greener planet, in that war against global warming, sorry, not going to be with you, going to drive my Humvee. In fact, going to give people a $100,000 tax credit if they buy a Humvee. So there's no question that we have to live up to our principles. We have to be the best global citizen we can be. There's no question that we have to be good listeners. And we've gotten away from being good listeners, certainly in the last couple of years. And listening is a sign of respect, to begin with. Going to someone's country and just listening is a sign of respect. And this administration is made up of terrible listeners. But at the same time, let me just finish. At the same time, it is deeply naive assume that somehow what motivated Osama bin Laden was the same thing that might have motivated someone from Chile. You know, if 9/11 had been done by 19 Chileans, I would have understood it perfectly. Here's our response, 30 years later to your intervention in our politics. But Osama bin Laden came from one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia. I can think of no particular grievance that the United States inflicted on him or his family or his neighbors other than advocating a kind of open, liberal society that empowers women has a completely different vision than he has. So, some people are, believe it or not, really bad and really twisted. I think it's really, really naive to conflate someone like Osama bin Laden with the victims of some American policy gone awry during the Cold War.
I'm not trying to conflate those two. I know Osama bin Laden is driven by his own religious fanaticism, just like the Nazis were driven by their racial fanaticism. But I see more of it like, for example, internal politics in Israel. I used to boast proudly, again, being a Jew, about how when the Shatila massacres happened in Lebanon, how about 10% of the Israeli population came out to demonstrate. Approximately 350,000 people marched, would be the equivalent of 28 million Americans coming out to march in protest. I used to tell people about that proudly, about how Israeli society was, mm-hmm. was a caring society. Now, under the influence of Sharon, even going back to his time as housing minister, and
Paul, minister, we've got to move on. So, is there a question?
Well, the question is, when do we see that the actions that are taken in various regions lead to this type of terrorism? It's not just a bubble. It's not just out of the blue.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Paul. We appreciate it. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Tom Friedman, this is a group of questions around the idea of blowback and the idea that the American foreign policy over many years has contributed to the anger that has redounded upon us at 9/11, the coal, any number of other incidents, and part of, I guess, the wider war on terror that you were talking about.
Look, this is about a lot of things. I did a documentary last year for the Discovery Channel on the roots of 9/11, and we went with a team all over the Arab Muslim world for over a period of about 6 months and interviewed people on what 9/11 was all about. And our conclusion was 9/11 was really fed by three rivers of rage. One was about what we do. what we, the United States, do, whether it's our how we use resources, it's our support for a dictatorial Arab regime so they'll sell us cheap oil, it's our backing for Israel when it does the right thing and when it does the wrong thing. 9/11 is fed in part by what we do, okay? And that is one of the important rivers of rage, but it's not the only one. The second and hugely important river of rage feeding 9/11 was a real overpowering sense of humiliation. You know, why is it that the key hijackers all were from middle and upper middle class families and all became radical Muslims actually in Europe, okay? It has to do with, as Ali Salem, the Egyptian playwright, put it, these young men feel like dwarfs, and dwarfs search out tall towers to bring down in order to feel tall. Okay, the Arab Human Development Report told us last year that 22 Arab states, not a single one, is has a free and fair, freely and fairly elected government. 22 Arab states do not have the GDP of Spain. 22 Arab states last year imported, translated, one-fifth the number of books that Greece did from English to Arabic, okay? This is a part of the world where half the young people want to move away. There is a deep sense of humiliation and a lashing out against successful societies and the biggest and most powerful one, the United States of America. That's the second river of rage. And the third river of rage is how much these people hate their own governments, governments that keep them voiceless and powerless and prevent them from achieving their full aspirations in a world where they know how everyone else is living. So let's get a grip on this. It is partly about what we do, and it's a partly about what they haven't done. And you need to keep that in balance because it means you have to address things in our own politics and in our own diplomacy, but you also have to partner with them to try to build decent, successful societies, okay, where people aren't going to feel humiliated. And 9/11, at its very root, is not about the poverty of money. It's about the poverty of dignity. That's when people really get enraged.
Earlier you said, talking about the messages received, that people will be held accountable. And I don't think there's any doubt that that was the message received in Afghanistan. Iraq was not in any way accountable for 9/11.
Yeah, it wasn't. We did Iraq for one simple reason, Neil, because we could. Saudi Arabia would have been fine. Pakistan would have been fine. The real truth is that we did Iraq because we could. Now, you can say that's unfair, that's terrible, it's all of those things. But the fact is, that's the real truth. That's why we did it, because Saddam was in violation of a whole plethora of UN resolutions, and so we could do Iraq.
But if there had not been that pretext, you're saying there would have been another one?
Maybe. I have no idea. But all I know is one thing. Having done it, we have a real moral responsibility now to do it right. And if we don't, God save us, the world will not be safe place for America if we don't get this right.
After a break, we're going to switch focus slightly to talk a little bit more about Iran and North Korea and the challenges they now pose, not just to U.S. foreign policy, but to the foreign policy of many countries around the world. If you'd like to join the conversation again, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said today that the recall election in California is on for October 7th. So with less than 2 weeks ago, we'll bring you an update on what's happening in that race. Today, we're talking with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or TOTN at NPR.org. And I do want to get to Iran and North Korea in a minute. But you were talking just before the break about how you thought we did Iraq because we could, and the weapons of mass destruction
was always a pretext.
If that's the case, there is great reaction now in both Great Britain and in this country, too. President Bush's numbers are going down about the legitimacy of the war and the stated reasons. And if those weren't the stated reasons, there's a whole issue of mendacity and honesty with the American public and saying what you need to say to get certain things done. Is this going to just continue to eat away as long as they can't find any rationale for behind the allegations of weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah, I think it will, Neil. I come at this issue with the odd position of before the war. I said, there's nothing there that threatens the United States. This shouldn't be the issue. Don't go down that road. And they chose to go down that road. Why did they go down that road? For a very simple reason. Iraq was always a war of choice. I happen to believe it was a legitimate choice, but it was always a war of choice. I believed it was a legitimate choice, but because I believed it was an audacious choice, I thought we needed to do it with as much legitimacy, as many allies, as much UN cover as we possibly could. But the president knew that it was a war of choice, but he knows something else. Democracies don't like to be asked to fight wars of choice. And if they do, they want them to be sprints, a la Bosnia, Kosovo, Haiti, or Somalia, not marathons. So what Bush and Blair did was turn a war of choice into a war of necessity by introducing the WMD issue. Now they've come to the post-war situation. Now they find themselves in a situation with no WMD, so people now understand that it wasn't a war of necessity, it was a war of choice. But what is even worse for them, they discover this war of choice isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. So now we discover we're in an $87 billion war of choice. And it's no wonder that people are feeling very, very angry. And I believe something happened during August, Neil. While the president was on vacation, I believe the American people started connecting some dots. They started connecting the dots of the ballooning deficits, the dots of the tax cuts, the dots of the casualties and the spinning of wheels in Iraq, the dots of the missing WMD. And I think in connecting those dots, they started to get angry. And I think that explains why we have polls this week showing General Wes Clark, the newly declared Democratic presidential candidate, comes out one day and he's already leading President Bush in the polls. Now, that can change, I realize. These are fickle.
And he's not the only Democrat who does well in that.
Right. It is telling you something that that there is a fundamental change of mood. And that's how I explain it.
One more call on Think on the Middle East. This is Zuhair, who joins us from the United Arab Emirates.
Wow. Yes, good afternoon, or I should say good morning, gentlemen. it's a pleasure to talk to you. And Mr. Friedman, I read your articles on occasion, and I enjoy them quite a bit.
Bless your heart.
I find it fascinating, just picking up on an issue that you mentioned earlier in the program, which is the how the administration approached the war with so little planning. But I would like to add to that and say that they've approached it with so little understanding as well of the area, of the region, and the dynamics of that region, how the Kurds, don't like the Arabs, and the Arabs don't like the Kurds, and the Turkmens don't like the Arabs. And so it seems like the United States has gotten itself into a mess in Iraq that it really didn't prepare for all that well. And I think part of it is that it doesn't understand it all that well either.
What do you think, Zuhair, that the United States should do to better understand it, or at least the Bush administration?
Well, I think the Bush administration should definitely listen to voices of reason. And though I disagree with Mr. Friedman sometimes, I think he certainly has a very good grasp of what's going on in that part of the world. And I think planning better and understanding what you're going into and what it's going to entail, and certainly legitimacy. Mm-hmm. Having a legitimacy cover for that war would have helped the United States quite a bit, I think.
Well, Zuhair, we'll get a response from Tom Friedman in just a moment, but I do think the White House does subscribe to the New York Times, so I suspect they do read what he has to say.
I hope so.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Zuhair makes a very good point, that this is, Iraq is probably the most complicated country in the whole Arab world. And that is both kind of the good news about it and the bad news. The bad news is complicated. The good news is because it contains strands of every part of the Arab world, Sunnis, Shiites, Kurds, Christians, Turkmen, if you are able to partner with the Iraqis to produce a kind of decent alternative there, it's something that would have a broad echo effect. Now, what I would say to Zuhair's point, it's at one level, I totally agree with him that these guys kind of marched into this war with such ideological blinders on. They were so caught up in the justness of the war as they saw it, they never wanted to look at the practicality. At the same time, only people with those ideological blinders would ever have done this. Okay? And I would say, you know, for so many years, we've kind of heard from experts and, you know, even people in the region, look, it's very complicated. You don't want to wade into this. It's very
complicated.
Just make
it worse.
Yeah, that's right. You'll just make it worse. And lo and behold, I'd say to Zuhair and to you, Neil, maybe we will. But maybe it's one time, I have to admit, there's part of me that just said, you know, let's just burst through all of this and actually see if we can begin to partner with people there to build a different reality. If we are always sort of intimidated by the quote-unquote, you know, complexities, you're never going to do anything. It's going to be paralyzing. Now, this isn't an argument for blindness or insensitivity. And as Zuhair said, you want to try to be as smart and as sensitive as you can. But at the same time, that becomes, in the hands of some people, an argument for never doing anything. And that preserves the status quo. And the status quo is hardly a just one, hardly a fair one, and hardly one that is producing a future for young people around the Arab world that is one that they want to embrace.
Let's go to Joe. And Joe's with us from Eagle Creek in Oregon.
Hi. I wanted to ask Mr. Friedman about the legitimacy of the doctrine of preemption in the context of, one, the United Nations and the example that the United States sets by having such a doctrine, and also the fact that we found no weapons of mass destruction, and he had touched upon that earlier, that it was just an excuse. And are we a law unto ourselves? Is there anything legitimate about that, being wars of choice as a legitimate tool of democracy? Is this even possible? I mean, is power the only rule at the end of the day that you can do it, so it's okay to do it? I mean, that seems to be what's being said here. Mm-hmm. So I'd like your response to that, sir.
It's a good question, and please distinguish between me as an analyst here explaining what the administration did and my own columns, which have advocated from the beginning of this whole discussion a much more multilateral approach. And my attitude on the day after we went to war was, this is not how I would have gone to war, but I'm going to use this column to try to make lemonade out of lemons, because I think that there are issues here that are critically important for us, our future, our kids' future in that part of the world. I'm quite uncomfortable with the doctrine of preemption, because who decides? And my feeling is, if you're going to preempt, it has to be you know, with clear-cut evidence of a clear and present danger. Otherwise, every war appears like an American whim, not an international decision, basically. And it may be they will still find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and maybe that will change the whole discussion here. I don't know, but I'm as uncomfortable as the caller. In that I am for preemption. I think preemption is possible if it's done with international legitimacy. Now, it's conceivable that you'll find a situation where you feel such a clear danger and you can't get that legitimacy, and then you'll go to war. The Bush administration would like us to think that that was the case in Iraq. I don't think that that was the case in Iraq. But my attitude now is we're there. And now that we're there, I want to make the very best of it, because I do believe that changing the regime there creates an incredible opportunity for us and the people of the Middle East and for our kids to partner with an important Arab country to begin to put that region on a different track.
Our guest is Thomas Friedman, a columnist for The New York Times. His most recent book is Longitudes and Attitudes, The World in the Age of Terrorism. It's just out in paperback, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. The international, we're finally getting onto Iran and North Korea, and it has to do with the credibility of American intelligence and a lot of other things that we've been discussing, in, at least in passing. Now, recently, the IAEA, the UN's atomic watchdog, voted to give Iran a deadline to prove that it was come clean on its nuclear weapons program at the end of next month. This week, Iran responded by saying it would cut back cooperation with the IAEA, though what's going to come out of this is not exactly clear. But what do you make of this? Is the evidence of Iranian involvement in nuclear weapons programs is hard to dismiss at this point.
It's a real problem, Neil. It's a problem for two reasons. One, in and of itself, Iran is clearly dedicated to acquiring a weapon of mass destruction. I have no doubt about it. And this is the dark side of the axis of evil. When the United States says you are part of the axis of evil, and so was Iraq, and you see what happened to Iraq, the first thing you're going to do is run out and try to get a nuke to deter us. That's what North Korea has done, and I believe that's what Iran is doing. So in some ways, we've certainly hastened that process, although I'm sure it was, you know, in train for a while. Here's what worries me. That's going down one track. You know, how do we deal with this? The IAEA, deadlines, you know, confrontation looming with the United States possibly and the whole world over that issue. On the other side, Iraq is, last time I looked at a map, right next to Iran. And Iraq has enormous influence within the Iran has enormous influence within the Iraqi Shiite community. And Iran could be an enormous help for us.
Or?
In Iraq, or an enormous source of trouble. And my mantra right now is very simple. We have to get Iraq right. And I believe everything should be subordinated to that. And I'll tell you why I believe that. If you say, Even the Iranian nukes, well, Lord knows, I hope we can do everything to deter Iran from getting a nuke. But if we get Iraq right, if we produce a reasonably decent democracy in Iraq, it will be a Shiite-dominated democracy. It'll be a Shiite-dominated pluralistic society. It'll be a Shiite-dominated country with a free press and some freedom of real freedom of religion. What is the greatest threat to the theocracy, the mullahocracy in Iran? It's in Iraq, right next door, led by the same kind of Shiites, that is a pluralistic, decent, forward-looking democracy. Our Iran policy should be Iraq.
For good or ill, as far as I know, there are very few Shiites in North Korea.
That is correct, as
and
far as I know.
That is a different kettle of fish. Even the procedure's different. A six-nation roundtable discussion, which seemingly at least agreed not to preclude the possibility of another meeting down the road if that's progress in North Korea. No specific deadlines there, but clearly this is, a lot of people say, more dangerous than anything.
I'm sure it is, but I have two answers about North Korea. First of all, the whole problem makes my head hurt because I've read the number of trees that have been killed for op-ed pieces on how to deal with North Korea. I weep for the forests. Number one. Number two, the North Koreans, looks like they have a nuke. They're probably going to get a few more. And my message to them is very simple. Guys, if they deliver milk, give us a call. If they lay eggs, give us a call, okay? But other than that, you can have your nukes. Suck on your nukes, okay? But we're not going to trade with you. We're not going to deal with you. You try to sell them to somebody, we'll stop it. You've got your nukes. We can't do anything about it. We got 35,000 American troops there on South Korea that are hostage. But now, as I say, if they give milk and lay eggs, good luck to you. But if not, you may want to come calling. And the other thing I say about North Korea, Neil, we don't have a map here. But last time I looked at a map, let's see, North Korea was right here. And China was right there next door. And Bethesda, where I live, is half a world away. And they couldn't hit me if the wind were right, okay? And the fact is, at some point, I'm not going to worry about every problem in the world. If China isn't going to worry about it and do something about it, if Japan isn't going to worry and do something about it, little Tommy Friedman living in Bethesda, I'll just chalk that up to one other thing in the world I'm not going to worry about right now.
Did you get your power back?
I've got my power back. We only missed it for a day.
Oh, that's not so bad. Others in Bethesda weren't so lucky. Tom Friedman, thanks very much for coming in today. We appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Tom Friedman is a columnist for the New York Times, the author of Longitudes and Latitudes. The subtitle is The World in the Age of Terrorism. He joined us here in Studio 3A. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.